disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up,
don't you dare give up. Don't you dare give in. Welcome, friends, brothers and sisters, family, clients, adversaries, allies, and the random tea partier who may have joined us by accident. This is Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell joining you from our lavish New York City studios at the Progressive Radio Network for our Women's Rights in the Workplace show, Workplace Discussions for the Sane Among Us. How are you, Deborah? Hope you're well. Good evening.
Outstanding.
You know how excited I am.
I know you're very excited about today's guest.
And you know why I'm excited about today's guest, don't you?
I do. You want to share with everybody
else?
Well,
I want to share with everyone. It's because we're being joined today by distinguished law professor Vanessa Merton. We're not worthy. We're not worthy. And the only reason she's here is because she was my former law professor. She is Professor Vanessa Merton, a preeminent progressive authority on all things immigration. And she also happens to be my mentor and my favorite law professor ever when I attended the City University of New York Law School back in the day when the craziest wackadoodle Republicans we knew were Ronald Reagan, Ed Meese, and maybe Caspar Weinberger. So, you know, we all, I'm sure Vanessa longs for the dulcet days of yore before the madness of the right wing exploded through all of the things we've talked about on the show. The elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, the enactment of Graham Leach Bliley, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, Citizens United, etc. Effectively, I'm sorry, just adjusting my microphone. Thank you. Effectively overturning the Tillman Act and allowing direct corporate contributions to political candidates. And this is, of course, when corporations became people and money became speech. So it's far scarier now that we're steadily inching toward feudalism. I imagine that Vanessa might even agree with me on that. The number to call in, 888-874-4888. Again, if you want to ask the esteemed immigration professor, activist, and lawyer, and my friend, Vanessa Merton, a question, make it a smart one. She's very smart. The number to call is 1-888-874-4888. So let me tell you a little bit about Vanessa Merton and her massive contributions to this woeful planet of ours, and then you'll realize how lucky we are to have her here today to explain you everything you ever wanted to know about immigration that the corporate media doesn't tell you or want you to know. Vanessa is a Radcliffe and NYU Law School grad. She teaches and directs the Immigration Justice Clinic at Pace University School of Law in White Plains, New York. The clinic provides free legal services to non-citizens who otherwise could not afford legal assistance, including representation on applications for asylum or family-based status, in removal proceedings, i.e. deportation proceedings, and on petitions for crime victims and juvenile immigrants. Clinic student attorneys working under Vanessa's supervision meet with clients and conduct public education programs at community centers, schools, healthcare providers, and places of worship throughout the Hudson Valley, New York, as well as at state and federal detention facilities. And the students litigate in immigration court, the Board of Immigration Appeals, the Federal Circuit Courts, and the United States Supreme Court. They also all frequently collaborate with the residency program in forensic psychiatry at the esteemed Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Bronx Psychiatric Center, where Professor Merton is a member of that faculty as well. For 15 years, Professor Merton served as Pace Law School's Associate Dean for Clinical Education, my old job, as Bill Maher would say, and she was the Executive Director of John Jay Legal Services while creating and teaching clinical programs in access to health care and prosecution of domestic violence. Professor Merton also directed the clinical curriculum at City University of New York, Law School at Queens College. Yes, we go. Our studio audience is going crazy. That was my alma mater, and that's where I had the fortune of learning under Vanessa Merton's outstanding pedagogical skills and deportment. And
I can see you're pulling out all the stops for Vanessa.
I'm pulling out all the stops. I can't help it. This is all just from memory, no less. And she was a member of the founding faculty at CUNY. She also co-founded the Health in the Workplace Clinic, where I had my first experience with litigation and cross-examination. This was a law school clinic, was the first law school clinic to team occupational medicine residents from Mount Sinai with clinical law students to provide coordinated care, representation, and advocacy for workers injured on the job. Professor Merton began her career in legal education as a clinical professor at New York University School of Law. She received the 2012 Pace Law Faculty Award for Teaching Excellence, the 1995 Graduating Class Award for Outstanding Law Professor, the 1988 CUNY Law Distinguished Service Award for Teaching Effectiveness, I believe I voted for her for that, and the 2012 Elmer Fried Excellence in Teaching Award of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, not to be confused with the Elmer Fudd Award that I received on many occasions, which this award was the highest honor for an immigration law professor given. She was a Mellon Fellow at the Aspen Institute and a National Endowment for the Humanities postdoctoral fellow at the Hastings Center Institute of Society, Ethics, and the Life Sciences, where she also became the first associate for law. Her practice experience includes the Criminal Defense Division of the Legal Aid Society of New York and serving as a volunteer trial counsel at the First Department Disciplinary Committee prosecuting lawyers who neglected clients and violated professional duties. For her work setting up a 200-student emergency operation to assist people affected by 9/11, in 2002, Professor Merton received six national and local awards, including the Mark of Distinction Award of the National Association of Law Placement, the Father Robert Drinan Award of the Association of American Law Schools Section on Pro Bono and Public Service, the PS LawNet Pro Bono Publico Award, and the Pace Law School Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence in Public Service Lawyering. In 2001, the New York chapter of the National Employment Lawyers Association, that's my bar group, presented Professor Merton with the 15th Anniversary Award for her role as a founding director. And in 2008, Professor Merton was honored with the Alternative Chance Human Rights Award for the clinic's service to indigent Haitian refugees. And in 2010, she received the Servant of Justice Award of the Haitian American Cultural and Social Organization of Rockland County, New York, for her leadership in mobilizing lawyers and law students to assist earthquake-affected Haitians. And finally, Professor Merton, she's especially proud of her work as a 20-year member of the advisory board of the Mount Sinai Irving J. Selikoff Center for Occupational and Environmental Medicine, which in 2012 named her Woman of the Year, and as founding chair of the Institutional Review Board of the Community Research Initiative of the People with AIDS Coalition in New York, and a member of the AMFAR, AIDS Medical Research Foundation, Institutional Review Board. I'm sure I've left out a whole bunch of accomplishments given her 22-hour-per-day work cycle, but, you know, who can remember them all? Vanessa, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you, Jack.
Well, thank you for joining me.
Typically over the top, well, way over.
I can't help it. You as well.
Remind me if I get arrested that I got to hire you.
Well, maybe you wouldn't want me for that, but I doubt you'll get arrested. And look, you're someone who does such good, and I hold you up as a beacon of what a lawyer should
do. No, that's very, very sweet. Thank you very much.
It's accurate. So let me just go back. I just lost my screen here. So, thank you for joining us.
Jack,
Vanessa,
can you do me a favor and speak up a little bit?
Sure. Let me see if they can. Martin, can you adjust it so that the guest can hear us? Thank you.
Great.
So, thanks, Vanessa. You know, we can't speak with you, with a learned professor of immigration law and an activist of your stature today, without at least spending some time discussing the humanitarian crisis at our borders, the ethical issues involving tens of thousands of children fleeing, crime-ridden countries. But first, I just wanted to touch base because from our own labor and employment practice, we know that undocumented workers are among the most vulnerable and exploited workers in the U.S., and they're frequently the victims of discrimination. Discrimination, unpaid wages, wage theft issues. Can you hear me now, Vanessa?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They work in dangerous working conditions, uncompensated workplace injuries often, and when they attempt to remedy the abuse, they routinely face physical and immigration-related threats and retaliation. Now, if I'm right, and I think this was I was reviewing these stats this morning, about 22 million immigrants currently work in the U.S., and that's about, including about 6 million or more than 6 million who are undocumented, and about 250,000 temporary guest workers in low-wage industries. Many are paid,
that's right.
So they're paid minimum wage or less. They work in unsafe workplaces. They're often excluded. Those without documents are often excluded from the protection of our, basic core labor laws. So,
well, often they are not, in fact, excluded, Jack. It's that they believe that they are, both they and their employers, and sometimes their employers know better, but their employers attempt to make them believe that they have no coverage. For example, you mentioned workers' compensation for people who are injured on the job and unable to work, and that is a great source of frustration that I'm aware of because of my work up here with the Mount Sinai Occupational Health Clinic in Yonkers. A lot of immigrant patients there, and you are also correct that they often work in very dangerous professions and jobs, but also it's exacerbated because many of them work two or three jobs because of their great financial need. And so the problem is that they believe and they're led to believe that they can't apply for workers' compensation, but in fact they could. And that's one of the things that we work on as part of our clinic.
But is that because beside not being advised of their rights under our core labor laws, they're also intimidated or more easy to intimidate by the employers than perhaps someone who is not fearing removal?
Yes. Well, they're very concerned about getting involved in any official system or office or agency. And, you know, it's often difficult to overcome even when they trust us, but when we explain to them that really it's quite safe for them. What we cannot say to them is that it's completely safe. We cannot say it's categorically not going to happen, that ICE is suddenly going to raid the workers' comp court over here a couple of blocks from my office.
Right,
that's the problem. And once they get into the immigration system, all bets are off because the rules are, shall we say, extremely flexible. And
they
can be tamed almost without any limitation. And many people who would qualify and could qualify for regularization of their status can't handle the prolonged detention. So they essentially sign themselves out for deportation because they're kept in criminal detention facilities where they are at great risk for other reasons.
And without the benefit of assigned counsel.
Absolutely. There is no assigned counsel in the immigration system, anywhere in the immigration system, except very recently there has begun to be a movement toward assigning counsel to profoundly mentally disabled and mentally challenged detainees because of some very high-profile cases, very sad and horrible cases where people who were in fact citizens of the United States but were mentally challenged, were deported and ended up either dying or spending some horrible months wandering the random streets and being subjected to great violence in other countries. Our system is, unfortunately, as I learned to my amazement, really, when I first became involved with immigration work about 10 years ago, the system is very flawed very often, much more often than I ever would have guessed, people who actually are citizens by birth or by derivation, as we call it, actually end up in the system and getting deported.
Right. There was that, I think you had sent me an awful case about a man who had served in the U.S. Navy here and his entire family was here. His entire extended family was deported to Jamaica because of some 10-year-old, marijuana possession. Okay, so there are a lot of horror stories, and I assume when you were talking...
He was also a veteran.
A combat veteran in the Navy.
Yes.
So, am I right? I've been saying for years, I've been waiting for all these years to ask you if I'm right, when I say that we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in this country, we have an illegal employer problem in this country. If a couple of employers who were incentivized, at least historically, to hire undocumented workers went to jail, wouldn't there be far less demand? Isn't it like the usual, we go after this, you know, we're going after the sort of the symptom.
Let's arrest the hooker and not the...
Right, the pimp.
John.
Right.
Well, the pimp.
Yeah, that is a actually, Deborah, that's a comparison that is often made in this situation. It is partially true. The extent to which I'm going to disagree is this. Much of the motivation for immigrants who are not documented is a result of two things. One is that there is no rhyme or reason to our system. People believe that there's some sort of line that people get in, and they get a number, sort of like going to the supermarket. And if they would just be patient, eventually that they would happily be greeted. That is not true at all. We have this very complex, bizarre, incomprehensible system that privileges certain types of workers, for example. And what it means is that for many people who meet all the statutory criteria for admission to the United States, they're told, yes, the only problem is you're going to have to wait 22 years or 18 years or 15 years, or it's an arbitrary number because it goes up and down, it changes, you can't even make it predictable, but it's a very long time for people to be separated from close family members. Mm-hmm. Most human beings are not going to spend a third to a quarter of their lives separated from their spouses, their small children, their siblings, and their parents who may be about to die. And as long as we don't have an intelligent, organized family unification system, there is going to be undocumented entries to the United States. The other half of it is the conditions in the countries that people are coming from, primarily coming from in Central and South America, also China, also Vietnam, also Eastern Europe, also in recent years, Ireland, without documentation. And the reasoning for that has to do very little with the how well or how poorly employers are sanctioned in the United States. It has to do with the conditions in those countries of origin. And when the conditions in those countries of origin become totally out of control, in some cases economically, or as we see now with the Central American entries, because of essentially they've descended into complete, there's no functioning government, there's just a complete Wild West. Except it's saturated with guns, millions of guns that this country sent to those countries, and it's saturated with drugs that this country buys from those countries.
So
as a result of those factors, it reaches a point. It would almost not matter what was going on in this country if things continue to be as horrific as they are in some of the countries of origin.
But again, I'm anxious to focus on Central America and the child issue right now. But just to circle back, that we've always had that, haven't we? Always had countries.
Oh, it's not different in kind. No, you're right. It's a little bit different in degree at this time because the even the military in those countries seem to have given up completely on any attempt. In other words, it seems as if the narcotels have reach a tipping point in terms of their actual ownership and control of the government and the military in Honduras, in Guatemala, and in El Salvador.
To go back for one second.
to your question about the employers, I don't mean to suggest that you're not right, that if there were some kind of significant, criminal prosecution and jailing of employers for hiring undocumented people, there certainly would be a lot of impact. I cannot politically imagine that happening. And in addition, it would create a whole other set of problems because you certainly cannot trust the average normal employer to be able to understand that people, for example, right now we have a status of Haitian temporary protected status. People don't have green cards. They don't have anything that would be recognizable to an employer who hadn't taken a crash course in immigration law, but they are in fact authorized to work in the United States. And we frequently issue letters to people and agree to be on call to their employers to be able to substantiate that. We just don't have yet a coherent enough system to make it very feasible to have that kind of systematic enforcement.
And its incoherence is rooted in what specifically?
Well, in a way, I mean, it all goes back, right, to the fact that for most of the first 100 years and even 130 years of the United States, there was no regulation of immigration. Again,
right,
we hear from many people,
right.
Oh, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, oh, he followed the law. He came here when and he didn't break any rules.
Right.
He didn't break any rules unless he was a Chinese person, in which case the law of this country excluded him based on that racial identification for a period of about 75 years. But he didn't break any rules because otherwise there really weren't any rules. There were completely arbitrary enforcement officers who let people in or didn't based on all kinds of things. Did they think that they had some kind of illness? Did they have $100 in their pocket? But there was no real legal structure defining what the criteria were for admission to the United States on either a temporary or permanent basis. That's a very recent phenomenon. It began in the early 1920s, most people think probably because the beginnings of fear, because they felt that there were too many Jews and too many Eastern Europeans and Russians were beginning to, quote, flood the country.
Right.
And that was the beginning of legislation. And then later on, the quota system was imposed, which is our brilliant system that says that it makes sense to have a numerical cap for not only all of the sum total of immigrants to be admitted to this country each year, but then for each country. And depending, of course, countries can change, but we don't change. And the number, the numerical cap is the same for Belgium as it is for Mexico. So that is one
crazy,
of the reasons why immigrants from Belgium do not face a prolonged wait for a legal visa, not even a day. Immigrants from Mexico face decades. Even though they're both applying under the same criteria, they both meet the same criteria, theoretically they're equal.
Okay.
But in practical terms, nothing could be less equal.
So the
development of the law, it was very much what is referred to as a Christmas tree statute. That is to say, people would see that something wasn't working and wasn't supposed to be doing what it was supposed to accomplish, and they would change it by adding something on to the statute, adding a new program, adding a new section with a new requirement, adding a new process, adding new officers. But nobody has ever really tried to rewrite the immigration law from scratch to try to sit down and say, what would a system that was designed to work look like? And what kind of law would support that system? That's the big problem, and that's when people talk about comprehensive immigration reform, what they're talking about is that we have this corrupt, out-of-date, dysfunctional, non-system. Judges denounce it. There are hilarious opinions you can read by judges like Posner, who talk about how absurd it is and how no one could possibly understand what's going on. And that is also what generates both so many mistakes and so many rip-off artists and scam artists who take advantage of people who have no way of knowing that what they're being told is complete nonsense and that they're about to lose the money they so painstakingly have saved for many, many years, perhaps, to someone who will do nothing for them or, worse, will do something that will get them in trouble with the United States government.
So what do we do? Here we are, a nation of immigrants, as we always say, and most of us don't care because we say, I'm some mutt from Eastern Europe. Deb, aren't you Danish? You're a mutt. But, you know, again, we're all from somewhere else. So it comes to the point now where people say, well, again, how many do you want? going to have half a million, you know, to answer these questions for you know, those who, in a very seemingly rational way, push back and say, what are we supposed to do? Remain this sanctuary for anyone who wants to come here? Now, I had, you know, as you know, because I believe I'd gotten this information from you, 75 years ago, the German transatlantic liner carrying almost 1,000 Jews was turned away from the United States because the U.S. law didn't allow sanctuary for these Jews, right? So they, and they're going back to the Nazis, going back to the, you know, the pain that must have been on the return voyage. And, you know, people certainly today, I don't even know, it may even be a majority of sort of, you know, the electorate that just sort of emotionally feels that, you know, there are no jobs now for, of course, reasons that are not, that are, you know, we know who to blame, and it's not, you know, the immigrants. But the there are no jobs. We're here. Too bad. It's like, we got ours. We're here first. There's a limit. So now we have 45,000 children, according to, you know, the Homeland Security Secretary Johnson. There'll be 90,000 by the autumn. That even President Obama, with the money that apparently he's attempting to sort of throw at this now and do something, we're still talking about, and they're being kept, right, in really, I don't know, you know, uncompassionate, egregious, it's indefensibly bad circumstances. They're kids. So you tell me, I know I'm a bleeding heart liberal, but we have these kids. You've got this. I know you wanted to talk about the whole predatory, the notari, you know, what do they call the notarios, you know, the predatory folks that, you know, that, and again, unlike, remember, you know, the, so what you said also about that we're arming. So if we're talking about Honduras and Nicaragua and Central American countries where the murder rate is higher than in the Congo, right? In the, you know, and in every, in the worst.
In Iraq.
In Iraq.
It's about twice the rate of child murder and child homicide in those countries is about twice the rate of child homicide and death in Iraq.
So we have a serious crisis, and unlike the 938 Jews that came over on an ocean liner, these kids walked here, right, and many of them didn't make it through the most, you know, challenging circumstances. And we, and as you just mentioned, we created this situation more or less, not only our demand perhaps for narcotics, but if we provided the weaponry and we are the ones who, you know, sort of...
are feeding the violence that they're fleeing
from.
Well,
we trained their military. We trained we have supported extremely repressive and dictatorial governments that have no popular support whatsoever. You know, what I was going to say, my answer is usually that the way to deal with the pressure coming from immigrants is to address some of the causes.
Yes.
And I'll give you my somewhat facile, but I think indicative quick diagnosis, which is that if we spent anything like the $18 billion that we spend on enforcement and border control and the infamous fence, which we built at $1.3 million a mile, and so forth, if we had invested anything like that amount in three things, in water treatment and water distribution, in roads so that people could get food, could get stuff to market and get move around the countryside, and in most of all, in free schools, in potable water, in free schools, and in roads that function. In those three countries, we could have done that. We could have completely rebuilt those countries, practically, at a fraction of the cost of what we're spending on border enforcement.
Well, we could have done that for the tax cuts also for 25% of our corporations and the subsidies, right? So, I mean, anywhere we spend the money. Okay.
Well, I mean, and we're not even talking about, you know, I mean, the NAFTA, which is really...
Right.
NAFTA is, in some ways, step one. I hate to say it, but the Clintons were among the most pernicious with respect to immigrants to this country, but between the laws they embraced in 1996 and the enactment of NAFTA, which was just devastating in terms of the rural populations in not only the Central American countries, but many South American countries as well.
And why
then,
is that?
And then training the military. I mean, we don't hear as much about Colombia, but a few years ago, we had massive refugees from Colombia for very similar, for narcotel violence. And this violence is extreme. I mean, You know, I'm not going to try to turn people's stomachs by describing some of what I have heard but and seen pictures of. But, I mean, let's just say that they almost make the Nazis look civilized. I can only speak for myself. If I and my children were in that setting with absolutely no place to turn, there's no functioning government, the police are completely bought and sold by the narcotels, by the gangs, by MS-13. There's no, you know, you can have your own gun, but you can't defend yourself and your family against the gangs, the narcotel. There's just no way.
Right.
I would do anything. I'd get on a leaky boat. I'd hijack an airplane. I would do whatever I had to do to get away from there. And I would certainly do everything in my power to avoid being returned there. I mean, you're talking about not just certain death, but a horrible death.
A horrible death. Like, I mean, I will, you know, I'm reading Christian Omar Reyes, an 11-year-old sixth grader in the neighborhood of Nueva Suyapa, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. He knows three people that were murdered this year. Four others were gunned down on a nearby corner in the span of 2 weeks. And a girl his age resisted being robbed of $5. She was clubbed over the head, dragged off by two men who cut a hole in her throat, stuffed her panties in it, left her body in a ravine across the street from his house. So this is common. This is why, as you said, they would do it. So in this type of extreme, you know, the sort of the limits of human, you know, the capacity to sort of suffer, and of course it's all caused by humans on other human-on-human suffering.
That's a little, I mean, it is in some ways even more hellacious than what's been going on in Haiti, where some of it is inflicted by human beings, but a lot of the suffering has also been from natural causes as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to be a little bit, in a funny way, we're more inclined to be compassionate, it seems, of people who are the victims of some kind of natural disaster than of a human disaster. I'm not sure I understand why that may be, but the phenomenon you were alluding to, it's one of the things that's most frustrating about this discussion about the border, is that people make it sound as if Obama is just making this up as he goes along. He's making a stab, it seems, not in many ways, not well, but he's making a stab at trying to follow the actual law that the United States entered into in 1980, and which we agreed that we would follow the international standards for refugees. And these children, many of them, the conditions that they are fleeing from, it is recognized both American and international law that if the government of the country you are coming from cannot prevent or address your subjection to the equivalent of torture, then you are entitled, as a matter of law, to protection. To very minimal status. You don't get a green card. No, you don't get on a path to become a citizen. You can't bring anybody else over as a sponsor. There are many limitations. But the two things you're entitled to as a refugee is one, protection from being deported back to the country of origin, unless you commit a crime or do other things that cause you to lose that protection. And you have the ability to work if you otherwise meet the standards for our country. And that's really all that anyone is talking about. For what, after all, you mentioned, I think, 90,000 kids. The number I've seen projected for the end of this year is maybe 60,000. But really, of course, these are all estimates.
Right.
Those sound like big numbers, but let's remember, during World War II, millions of children were moved around and sent to various places to protect them, to avoid war all over the continental Europe and the United Kingdom and to the United States. We've taken in as many as 16,000 Cuban children without batting an eye back in the 80s. And no one said boo. That was, in fact, seen as absolutely an obligation on our part.
It served our just political end.
Right. Right.
I mean, saying it wasn't because we were more compassionate than or to Cuban kids.
you know, I've been always struggling trying to figure out what is going on. I mean, I think part of what you said at the very beginning may be part of the may generate the virulence of the response we're seeing. That is that people have been rendered deliberately by policies of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives much more economically insecure and with declining or stagnant wages and with declining value of assets and with no prospects for their children. And all. So as the United States population has suffered this grievous economic assault, really, from its own government, I think that has led people to become, much more protective and defensive and unwilling to recognize our legal obligations to these kids.
Doesn't it also have something to do with how either the media or how people are viewing these people and kids, that there's some belief that they're coming here for work when, in fact, the majority, as you were saying, are fleeing warlike conditions? And for the same reasons that, you know, we watch on the news and we see, you know, war breaking out all over Africa and, you know, Iraq and the whole Middle East and hundreds of thousands of people fleeing the violence. What happened to the United States looking at these people and particularly these children as, you know, refugees and not, takers. Interlopers. Interlopers. Invaders. Right. Invaders. Yes. Exactly.
Illegal alien invaders.
Yeah.
Right.
Alien, I mean,
aliens. Yeah, aliens, that's the word.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
And brown ones.
just to make it worse.
It does. Of course it makes it worse. So, exactly. So,
one comment I saw on one of these horrific, blog comments that one should not read, but I couldn't resist some of them, so now Obama wants to have all these brown children as well as all the black children,
I mean, we're very sick, but you know what, but like you mentioned NAFTA, to me, the whole NAFTA got, you know, all of them, the eradication of tariffs, and again, all since we used to make fun of the Republicans when they'd be thrown out of the party now, those Republicans, you have 100,000 factories that closed in the last 15 years. We have no middle class, so when you have people that are desperate, and Fox, you know, the Fox News and the echo chamber, that whole meme right now that, for instance, President Obama's enforcement policy caused this, I take it that you answer to that's ridiculous.
Oh, it's so beyond ludicrous. I mean, the notion that anybody, I would venture almost anybody in the countries we're talking about, has any grasp at all of this very limited executive order, deferred action for childhood arrivals that Obama did a couple of years ago. I mean, that's just so far-fetched. I mean, it's like believing that, you know, that the Wicked Witch of the West came down and it told them that they had better leave and come to the U.S. I mean, it's about as believable. People in this country don't understand the law of immigration at all.
But then,
people who are working in the system don't understand the law at all. Far from people living under conditions of very limited education and access to information. It has nothing to do with that.
So what does it have to do with, and how should people feel? What should we? And I mean that in terms of, because a lot of people, like, tell me what to feel.
Well, one thing that we do have to do, because it's probably fair to say, I have to say this, I mean, I don't want to in a way because I don't want it to be used in the wrong way, but one has to say in all honesty that there are probably some small proportion of people in the overall groups that are arriving at the border these days who are primarily economically driven. That's always been the case, and there's no reason in my mind to think that that stopped being the case. That's why we need a rational adjudicatory system. Actually, the best functioning part of our immigration system, although that's really not saying much, is the immigration courts. And it would be possible, I think, to It might be incredibly inefficient for the United States' own interests. I mean, there is an alternative which people are talking about. There's a section of the statute which gives the President of the United States the right and the power to declare an entire population refugees. And it's been used a few times before in some of the instances I mentioned. And it would in some ways make much more sense than trying to sort out exactly and, you know, find the 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 7 or whatever it is, person who maybe is not from one of the countries that's completely dysfunctional or is in some way protected, or there certainly might be people who don't qualify under our refugee standards. And okay, I'm willing to live with a system of looking at the cases that doesn't compromise due process and basic rights. It is a very unfortunate feature that people, for the most part, would never have lawyers. Congressman Smith from Washington this morning, very bravely, I thought, came out and basically said, you know, it's disgusting that the government pays for lawyers to try to deport people, especially these children who don't even understand the language, et cetera, let alone the law. But there's no provision for resources, and he called for some resources for representation and assistance to these kids. That certainly would be nice to see. What would also be nice to see is that, as you may recall, Obama has requested from Congress, which doesn't seem to be doing anything despite all of the hand-wringing, has requested several billion dollars to, among other things, set up emergency courts near the border to start this process I'm describing of figuring out who are refugees. And the bone I have to pick with that is what he's proposed is that these temporary judges would be either former retired judges or they would be the government attorneys who spend their time trying to deport people and who would be, quote, temporarily anyway, assigned for 6 months to sit in as judges with the people litigating in front of them, their colleagues and perhaps their bosses to whom they have to return after 6 months. This seems like an atrociously bad idea if you're actually trying to get to the truth of individual cases.
Right.
It's no question it will be an expensive and difficult process, and I can only, you know, quote the great Lou Reed. You know, you're going to reap just what you sow.
All right.
And we did sow. We sowed this, all of this.
Well, but what about now, being we always have a chance? It's like, at least from the film depiction of Gandhi when he was fasting, and I guess a Muslim came to him and said, "I'm living in hell. I killed the." I don't remember who was who, but he said, "I know a way out of hell." The way out of hell. Now, this we may have sown this, but the question is, do you consider the bulk of this wave of children from Central America to be refugees? Number one.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it.
Okay.
They're not economically motivated. They're kids. I mean, some of them are young adults. They're the youth, 16, 17. But, you know, there may be some among them. I represented a little girl, 7 years old, not too long ago. And I would say that it was a very troubling process for her to get to the United States, very terrifying. You know, some of these kids set out to do this without any consultation with adults, and they don't even understand that, you know, when they're going to the United States, they're starting out from a little village in Guatemala, and they think it's going to be like a 20-mile walk. I mean, they don't really know what they're getting into. It's fair to say that her primary problems were, a grandfather who had been taking care of her since her parents left for the United States, and who was now that she was getting to be that age was starting to molest her. And secondly, she just wanted to be with her parents. She wanted to find her parents and be with her parents. Now, I don't know how you want to characterize that. I mean, technically, we made a pretty good argument, I think, that she qualified for asylum, because the reality is, in Guatemala, there's no chance that if her grandfather started molesting her, that anybody was going to do anything about it.
Right.
Nobody was going to stop it. Nobody was going to punish him. No, there was no place for her to go. There was no one for her to go to. It's a classic example of a government failing to provide, to prevent the equivalent of torture. But I can't say that for sure it would have been interpreted as such by one of our immigration judges. I mean, fortunately, we were able to avoid that for various reasons. But it's very difficult to come up, Jack, with a panacea, with something that's going to solve all of these massive problems that we have generated over the last several generations, really.
Right. And it's all connected, but it just seemed to me, you know, reading about international protection obligations, it's like if we've caused this, they are kids, they're kids that if we did want to spend the money, if we spent the money the way we should be on our own, you know, on the things that matter, whether, again, just for back to infrastructure, creating jobs, you know, rail beds, waterways, bridges, create, you know, have another New Deal, another great society, and do it. We can, these 50,000 kids, they'll be our next.
Home care of elderly and disabled people.
Right.
I mean, there's so many jobs that are desperately needed to be done. And traditionally, native born Americans have not been standing in line for these jobs at all. That's a very big part of the reason. It's true in some cases that the immigrants work for less money, I suppose, but are less trouble because they are more scared. But the reality is that when I think about the meatpacking plants in the Midwest, when I think about the fish processing and seafood processing plants on the New England coast, there's no question that these facilities which have made these little communities they're in economically vibrant in a way they never would have been otherwise. They could not function without immigrant labor.
Right.
And whether, you know, there's much to be done in the way of unionization and other things.
Well, but unionization, you know, we've gone in our adult lifetime from 39% unionized workers to, like, roughly, 6% now in the private sector?
Yeah. No,
so, I mean,
it's
all
horrifying.
It's horrifying. So I suppose, you know, we have one major political party that stands for nothing but obstructionism, corruption, anything Obama wants, they don't. Probably very happy to crash our economy. I mean, we know if you're not, again, we're not sort of misdirected by, you know, the either the corporate media or, again, that echo chamber that wants us to lead us by the nose down the wrong path. We know that everything that's going wrong is going wrong because we can't get anything done. So when we look at this crisis right now, that, and again, as an immigration, someone who has fought for the rights of immigrants who came after us to, I mean, again, I assume you agree, it sounds like, obviously, as someone who studied these issues these many decades, you have a sane, reasonable, I'm sure out there somewhere there's some model legislation of what a sane policy would look like. But right now with these kids, the traffic.
Well, we're so far from that, Jack, that it's almost.
Yeah.
I mean, there is disagreement among people, reasonable people, I would say, about immigration policy. It's really one of the most difficult legal issues I've ever grappled with as to what should it be, whether you should be giving points to people for various characteristics, whether you should just be assigning, so to speak, you know, creating a line, numbers, a numerical, and first come, first served. And then you have to decide how much you can absorb over the course of any given time period. I don't think it is an easy task, but we are so far away from anything remotely resembling an ideal policy that I don't even actually these days spend much time thinking about it.
Well, then is it learned helplessness? At this point, when we're looking at these kids, you've got the TVPRA, the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, you've got Safe Passage Project, the Special Immigration Juvenile Status, because otherwise, again, most of these kids are going before they're completely outgunned, obviously, except for the Safe Passage Project in New York. Is that associated with that?
Well, I work with Lenny Benson, with the director of that project, a lot. But the difference is she coordinates pro bono attorneys who are willing to volunteer to handle some of these cases, whereas I work with my student attorneys and offer direct representation.
So just directly, quick direct question, what do you think we should do with the bulk of these kids from Central America?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's hard to if we are going to err on the side of efficiency, so to speak. What I mentioned before, in other words, it's kind of like in the criminal system, we have this notion that it is better for for many guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be locked up or killed. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, on the one hand, if you're going to do a mass solution that's going to try to absorb 60 or 90,000 kids this year, then it has to be a declaration of refugees, and then a lot of things follow from that that actually are not that expensive, that would be cheaper than the adjudication process and the border patrol, the surveillance, and the ankle bracelets, and all the other things that have to go into place as soon as you invoke that. Mm-hmm. And basically send the kids through the Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Assistance, and we actually have millions of people out there who welcome child refugees for sort of it's kind of like temporary foster care, mm-hmm. and help get them established and get them into schools and get them with and there's money that can be tapped into to provide support for local schools and local hospitals and so forth. I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult to ramp that system up from where it has been around 20,000-25,000. It would definitely be some effort, but it would not be impossible. On the other hand, if you're not willing to do that, my sense is that as Americans, unfortunately or not, we seem to be very focused on individualized, fine-tuned, and we want to have exact justice, which is very hard to achieve. Then, you know, you really have to provide the kids with representation, and you have to have an adjudicatory process, and we just have to treat them as our law says with respect to their individual circumstances. That would likely be quite an expensive process, mm-hmm. and it would take a long time. Mm-hmm. And the problem, I think, that the Obama administration, the response they would make to this is, well, we can't do that because if the kids stay for even a month,
yeah.
The message that we'll send back is, although this is exaggerated because many times people in the home countries don't know what happened to the kids necessarily, but there is some truth to that, and there is some truth to the fact that if, you know, I know it is true that some of the immigrants, refugees who've been released from custody at the border and have been given their summonses for the immigration courts, they themselves are confused. They don't know, and they interpret it as, oh, now I have a work permit. Mm-hmm. You know, now I have some kind of status. They have a piece of paper, which they may be in a language, even if it's in Spanish. Many of the people from these countries do not speak Spanish or read Spanish. And as I understand it, it seems that you know, reputable researchers say yes, there is some miscommunication going back to those countries telling people, oh good, you know, if you can just get there, there is some opportunity for some kind of status. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are other ways to deal with that. I mean, one, we have incredibly effective advertising and publicity professionals who, seems to me, ought to be able to go into that country, and heavens knows we ought to have carte blanche from these laughable excuses for governments that we've been propping up, and, you know, make sure, get the message out very clearly that that's not what is going on. I mean, at least try that.
Try it, because we are the big bad big brother of, you know, the world that has, if to a certain extent, cause this problem. It's almost like income,
yep.
inequality here, the sort of income inequality globally, you know, again, where the gun purveyors of the world, so we should bear some sort of countervailing force.
It kills me sometimes to have conversations with some of political opponents who, particularly they're very, very religious people, and when I say, look, you know, as I said to you a moment ago, you reap what you sow. Why is that not just? Why is that not right? Why is that not appropriate? In many other ways in their lives, they insist that they adhere to that notion, but they don't want to deal with it and accept that as a premise even here. But I think it's very difficult for anyone who really looks, even for 20 minutes, at the history of the United States policy to not see the connection.
And, you know, again, Jesus wasn't, you know, turning them away. And Jesus was, again, a radical liberal, right? So,
yeah,
you know,
well, I mean, Jesus said, you know, shelter the refugee. I mean, there's absolutely, there's tons of material in the Bible. I also have a whole collection of biblical quotes. But they absolutely, the stranger. Love the stranger in your land. I mean, that is in the Old Testament. It's part of not only the roots of Christianity, but also Judaism and Islam.
Well, then you
would think the Republicans would embrace this.
Right.
You would think.
Well, they embrace, you know, the religion of Ayn Rand. Let me ask you, I think we just have a couple of minutes here, Vanessa.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you, you had, you know, written a bunch of years ago, we have 1 minute. I just wanted to ask you, your paper on the exclusion of pregnant, pregnable, and once pregnable people, a.k.a. women, from biomedical research. And reason it's important, we're not going to be able to do this justice in a minute, but I was just wondering, here you have, and this was, you know, an erudite 80-some-odd page, you know, paper, it was wonderful, but the idea that, summed up by the ACT UP poster, that mice have a better chance of getting experimental AIDS drugs than women, at least back in the day, and that all of these clinical trials are concentrated on middle-class white men, still, probably, right? More often than not.
It is. There has been a little movement on that, Jack, but it is still very much a live issue, and I'm going to be writing another piece later this year trying to address it in disbelief that 20 years later.
Right.
Well, that'll be the next topic.
Well, because then they find out in the interim, I read something somewhere that this is, since then, it's clear scientifically, physiologically, biomedically, that women are different. Right. I mean, you can't give a woman Lipitor the same that you've tested on a man.
Right. The metabolism, the percentage of different kinds of cells, everything, it's very different. But the big issue, the hot wire issue that I'm going to be writing on later is the continuing refusal to allow pregnant women to make the decision themselves, which is what I was writing about, that it should be up to pregnant women themselves to decide whether it's their condition or whatever the situation is requires or validates their participation in biomedical research protocols.
Never-ending reproductive rights challenges we face in the religious divide. Vanessa, what's the Facebook page again for our listeners, the Immigration Clinic?
The Immigration Justice Clinic. If you just go to Facebook and put in Immigration Justice Clinic, it's the Immigration Justice Clinic of Pace University Law School, but Immigration Justice Clinic will take you. I try to post most of the responsible commentary and also research reports and materials so that if people really do want to get up to date on various issues in immigration, that it provides a simple way of doing it.
Outstanding.
Thank you so much, Vanessa.
Oh, well, it was a great pleasure, Jack. Thank you so much for having me on. I've been waiting for this.
You're quite welcome. May we have you back sometime?
Absolutely.
Right.
I would be delighted.
Thank you very
much.
Take
care, Deborah.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's our show for the day. Are we still on, Martin? Okay, so we hope you enjoyed Professor Vanessa Merton talking about the intractable problem of our immigration injustice system. So no easy answer, even from the top expert, what can I tell you? But it was a pleasure having her. Join us next week, 5 p.m., on the Progressive Radio Network, the Women's Rights in the Workplace show. Until then, remember, don't quit.